Okay, this is continuing with Jim Roberts on 28th February 78.
Well, Kevin Westfall with I think it was Bolton, Stanley, and Slee did the 100 megahertz server.
That's right.
And they wanted to deconvolve it, as we now say, and Kevin had produced this theory. And he spoke about it at Cambridge while I was a student there. And there was a lot of disbelief because they'd been brought up on Fourier theory at Cambridge. Not long after I came back to work at CSIRO, all this came up again and was discussed. And I suppose at some group meeting or some talk about this, I must have opened my mouth. And so Borsi asked me if I'd collaborate with Ron Bracewell in this. Well, of course, I really didn't know anything about it. Ron had been brought up in Fourier theory. He knew all about it. And so I simply tagged along and helped a bit with the writing and learnt a bit. So that's how that happened.
So this is mainly Bracewell's paper, then, you would say?
Ah, yes. I'd say the general idea of it was Ron's. You know, some little notions in there, a dear to me trying to understand it and Ron trying to express himself so as to bring it out. Incidentally, you know, I often wonder now whether that paper set back radio astronomy a long way by saying you shouldn't push up the high frequency components.
You mean that it made people not try to go to higher resolution?
Well, it made people believe that it was wrong to use any restoration process which pushed up the frequencies beyond where you'd measure them. Whereas I think that's a lot of rubbish, and a lot of the processes that are favoured these days do just that. And maximum entropy particularly does that.
Oh, okay, now I see what you're saying, but now I'd be interested, of course there were several papers by Bracewell in the mid-50s on this topic, and how were they accepted at that time? Did people say, aha, well this is something that's useful?
Oh, gospel, I guess.
Right, so
as I saw it, the thing which got spelled out clearly in the Bracewell and Roberts paper was that you were looking at Fourier components, which of course was known before, I mean, that's in the literature before, but that the aerial didn't accept any beyond the size of the aerial, and that you, if you started putting those back in, you were looking for trouble. And it's that last bit which I now think is not a sensible notion, which Ron defended long after I'd given it up. I mean,
well, okay. Well, let's look at the two results that the abstract here said. That the lack of the highest Fourier components meant that it was possible to have invisible distributions which produce no response. Now, what does that term mean, visible distribution?
Well, you can have a distribution of brightness on the sky which produces absolutely no response to an aerial because it contains no Fourier components in the band accepted by your aerial. Now, you can't have such a thing on a zero background because it would then have to go negative.
Ah, okay.
It
so
it has to be added.
So these are the broad components. I see what you're saying.
No, I'm sorry. Not necessarily broad.
They would be broad in interferometer, right, but not necessarily in another kind of...
No.
Okay, straighten me out here.
We were thinking of a dish where you accepting all the Fourier components up to a certain thing. In other words, all the structure down to a certain narrowness. And it's the structures which are narrower than that, which have fast variations in them, which the dish doesn't see.
Which you wouldn't see anything of.
No, they're just smoothed out by the dish.
So it's not that you wouldn't see any signal, it's that you wouldn't see any of that structure.
Well, you can make shapes in the sky.
You would get the total flux from it. That's what I was...
Oh, yes, you'll get...
That's what I was invisible.
Yeah, no, the invisible distribution...
The flux is not invisible, but the actual distribution of the flux is invisible, so to speak. Or the fact that there is...
Yes.
You can't tell one distribution from another. That's what you're
all getting. The invisible distributions have zero power.
Right, I see what you're saying. And the other point you made apparently was that sampling at discrete intervals is sufficient.
Yeah, mind you, that's sampling theorem. That comes out of previous theory, but it was new to us, I suppose, in a sense.
But still, I'm interested in this point that you make, that this was accepted as gospel, and therefore people, would you say, were trying to they were not trying to deconvolve in any sense.
Not many people tried deconvolving after that. Some did. Some said, oh, you know, so what? And tried deconvolving. But there was not a strong pressure to say, what is the best representation of the data? You see, this is the way maximum entropy or something like that looks at it. They say, here's a set of observations in a transform plane. What's the best way of representing it in the real domain? Maximum entropy actually says that to put no Fourier components beyond there is a damn silly thing to do, because in the real plane it produces lots of maximum minima, which, you know, don't happen.
Right.
And it actually tries to get a very flat area in the real domain, which necessarily means putting these components in you can't measure. So that it's a very different philosophy, a very different way of looking at things.
But it took, like you say, the entire 60s was sort of a no man's time when no one was worrying about these things, because it more or less had been established by Bracewell.
Yes, because I think that paper also and Bracewell's subsequent writings brought home the Fourier thing more. And of course, so did the Cambridge work on synthesis. I mean, it wasn't that these ideas weren't understood before, but they weren't really applied. And all the Cambridge work on synthesis, of course, depends on using different Fourier components.
But I'm still struck by your remark that you think it probably did more of a disservice to the field than.
Oh, no. No, I'm not. I wouldn't say that. No, I think it was very educative. You know, it is, I think, a basic paper of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
If it had taken some different attitude about what you did, because you couldn't measure the high frequency components,
then I see what you're saying.
We might have gone in some slightly different direction earlier.
I see what you're saying.
Oh no, I think it was a very sound paper, and it did a lot to help people understand what was going on.
Okay, well, let's take a break now.
Right.
Okay, it seems like the next area you got into, or continuing with solar bursts, and if we do this chronologically, there was a paper in 57 with Laffed, is it pronounced?
Yes, Ralph Laffed.
And McCabe on correlation of type 3 bursts with chromospheric flares, and basically concluding that the relation was not so simple. And then you had another paper while we're on this theme of optical and radio of type 2 bursts, looking for optical counterparts, finding 13 out of 15 cases had them. This was with Giovanelli.
Yes.
Can you tell me what was the thrust behind this optical radio collaboration?
Well, it's funny the things that this recalls to mind.
After that spectrograph was constructed and going, and sometime after I'd been working down there for a few years, Paul Wild went off to Harvard to help them build their spectrograph. And I guess I was left in charge of the Dapto station during this time. And your comments here recall a discussion at Pawsey where I was arguing, you know, we've got to have this optical collaboration. We've got to find out what's going on in the optical at the same time as what's going on in the radio. And there were, I don't know what the difficulties were, but there were some great difficulties about scheduling this or arranging it or something. And I seem to recall saying, you know, useless to do the observations if we didn't have the optical observations, and Fawzi saying, well, maybe it's useless to do them. I mean, it must have been difficult to arrange the thing, and he wasn't going to be pushed. Nothing much came out of those optical collaborations.
Where were these people from?
They're from the Division of Physics at CSIRO, who were part of the National Standards Lab, which shared the building with us where we used to be. And Giovanelli was the head of the group. Ralph Luffett and Murray McKay were two of his people. And I'm not sure where their telescope was at that stage. It might have been at Fleurs, in fact. It probably was at Fleurs, and they observed with Leo filters and things at Fleurs.
Were they enthusiastic about this cooperation?
Oh, yeah.
Was initiated by you?
Couldn't tell you, probably, since I recall that argument with Fleurs about getting it done. But as I say, not much came out of it. Yeah, we were both observing the sun, and obviously you should try and observe at the same time if you can. But there'd been a long history up to then, and I suppose since, of lack of correlation between optical and radio. You've got to get the right bandwidths to see much correlation.
So even at that time, it was known that there was not the world's best correlation.
Oh yes, there'd been previous studies of correlations between flares and radio bursts. I guess everybody who saw a big radio burst looked to see if there'd been a big flare. Sometimes they had, of course, in the very big bursts. Anyway, I don't think of those as important papers as progressing much.
It's interesting that, like you say, it must have been some political difficulty or something, because Pawsey was, I've been told, quite enthusiastic about cooperation with Bach.
I'm sure he was all for it. It was just that it was difficult to arrange it. I think maybe there were no funds for something or other, or there was no something. I can't really remember that. I just recall that to mind.
Well, tell me. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the papers that I remember from that period are the one on type 2s, which was a sort of a summary of all adapto work. I mean, my name's on it, I did a lot of the analysis, but it's covered a period, I don't know, of six or more years of observations with adapto spectrograph. And the other intriguing one was on those reverse drift pairs.
Right, well, let's start off with reverse drift pairs. Now, that terminology I didn't
see. Well, it probably says evidence of echoes and solar coronas.
Yes, right, echoes, right. Is this, no, I'm not in the solar game, so
right.
Is this with the modern terminology, reverse drift?
I'm not sure what they, there are a lot more of these things have been discovered more recently, and it's not, I think, clear that they really are echoes. You'd need to talk to the modern solar people to find out what the present situation is.
What were you observing at that
time? The spectra, the radio spectrum of the sun was observed all the way from 40 to 240 megacycles in three bands. And we used to run the spectrograph every day that we could. And then it was the duty of one or another person to go through these films afterwards and see what was on them. And I guess I must have noticed these things, which we started to call reverse drift pairs, which were brightenings in the time frequency plane, which drifted with time in the opposite sense to type 3s and type 2s. In other words, as if something were going into the sun rather than coming out of it. And they occurred in pairs. And after some examining quite a number of these, the evidence seemed to favour the idea that they were delayed in time rather than being separated in frequency. And if you put the numbers in, you could make a reasonable story for the delay being a second harmonic of the plasma frequency going down to where it would be reflected and coming back again.
How do you distinguish between those two possibilities of the delay in time and a different frequency?
In the simplest model, if they started at the same time and ended at the same time but were displaced in frequency, you would think it's a frequency split. If they start at the same frequency and end at the same frequency, but are shifted in time, you think it's a time split. Well, it was not as clear cut as that, but it favoured the time.
I see.
Now, I think Ron Stewart told me that more evidence of recent years perhaps doesn't make it nearly as clear cut.
Well, that seems to be true with everything that's about.
But it was a nice thing to me, because it did seem to fit a pattern. The time delays did seem to fit the theory, and the tape's still going around.
So I actually presented the type 2 paper. I don't know whether the echo one got presented at the Paris Symposium.
Only the type 2.
The type 2. I'd decided it was, I'd like a change, I'd like to go somewhere else. And John Bolton was in charge at Caltech, and Taffy Bowen very easily arranged for John to offer me a job. And so at the time of the Paris Symposium, I was actually on my way to Caltech via the Paris Symposium and the Moscow IAU.
But your whole background had been in solo work.
Right, that's so a bit unusual, is I was that, going to start some new field.
I see. You were ready for that at that time also?
Yes.
Before we get into that, can you tell me about the herringbone structure and the band splitting and so forth that you were finding at that time?
Features of type 2 bursts. I don't think that I actually found either of those things myself. I think that Paul was aware of those from quite early on. But some of the type 2 bursts, in fact quite a few of them, both the second harmonic and the fundamental band are split, so they're double.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, what was causing this? And I think in that paper we simply summarised a lot of the information about how wide this split was and how it varied with time and frequency, and theorised about what might be causing it. The herringbone structure, sometimes one or both bands look like the backbone of a fish instead of simply being a simple streak on a dynamic spectrum record. There are fish bones coming out of them,
mm-hmm.
with the slope about equal to that of a type 3 burst. And so the suggestion, which I'm pretty sure came from Paul, was that you have the shock front, which is producing the type 2 burst, very slow drifting type 2 burst, about 1,000 or 2,000 kilometers a second, somehow producing the relativistic electrons, or third C electrons, which are going both forwards and backwards from the shock front and producing local type 3 bursts.
I see.
And I think that this is the generally accepted theory now of how type 2 bursts radiate, that somehow the shock front produces the third C electrons, and they're the ones that produce the plasma oscillations, which ultimately produce the radiation.
Now, this Paris Symposium, as I was mentioning, seems to me to be an important meeting in the development of radio astronomy. Do you have any particular recollections from that? From the solar side in particular?
Well, I don't have any very clear recollections, I suppose. I'd been working in solar radio astronomy. I was obviously going to a place where I was going to do something other than solar radio astronomy, so I took an interest in the whole symposium, but my background, recent background at least, was in solar. There was no doubt, I think, that Wilde's group was the leading solar group, and so to a large extent it was us telling the rest of the people what we've been doing, mm-hmm. because there was a strong French group. I do remember people like Bernie Mills and Burbage and company talking, but I don't think I have very clear memories of it.
Yeah. So your impressions at that time seemed to me to be just that it was another international meeting, not particularly that it was...
Oh, it was obviously a very big meeting. It was the first radio astronomy symposium, wasn't it? No, there'd been one in 55.
Right. It was actually the last, because after that you couldn't have a radio astronomy symposium.
Okay. But it was a very big meeting. It was fascinating while it was on, I can recall that much, but, you know, actual details and...
You bring up the French group. Let me just ask you your opinion on... I've interviewed several of them a couple of years ago, and I have a difficulty evaluating exactly what their contribution has been.
Who did you interview?
Oh, all of them.
Denise
and Bloom and Washo and Kundu. But I'd be interested in your opinion as to what their main contribution was up to 1960 or so. Or do you think that they were always sort of always tagging a bit behind?
Oh no, I don't think they were tagging behind. It's very hard for me to think back to the 1960 or so and say what their contribution was.
Let me put it this way. When you were working on all these things in the late 50s, were you worried at all about the papers coming out of France? Or was it?
No, because we were the only people with spectrograph. The first time there was any competition was when the Harvard thing got going with Alan Maxwell.
But nevertheless, did not any of the French results have any impact on the picture of the sun that you had?
We were probably pretty insular. We had the past experience, I mean, before I joined the group, of trying to make sense out of single frequency records. And once you'd seen the dynamic spectra particularly, you knew how very difficult it was to tie together the peaks on single frequency records, know which went with which and what was going on. Now, I know at the time of, I think this is right, at the time of the Paris Symposium, we went to Nancy, and they had an interferometer that I think was at 160 megacycles for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It might even have had an east-west and a north-south arm.
Yeah, I can't quite remember.
And whether that was in fact producing positions that were good and that were useful, I don't know. You see, at that stage there were no positions from DAPTA, I think that's right. Or is that right? The Cygnus interferometer, I mean, when we did the scintillation work, we had an interferometer running, short frequency interferometer. And whether that was used for the sun?
I don't have any thing in the papers you were involved in on positions anyway.
No, there was no routine measuring of positions.
But certainly at around this stage, Paul Weil must have been thinking about that this was a real lack. And
oh yes, starting many of these morning tea discussions would be on, you know, how you could build a big array. And of course it wasn't many years afterwards that he was onto his ring.
Right. Okay, so
he certainly wanted to measure speeds of a third C and really clinch it. But now that was first done with the DAPTA interferometer. Paper by Sheridan, Nalan and Wild, or some such names.
I see.
So that would be probably after I'd gone to Caltech. Or
one other paper before we get to Caltech that you did with TWIS. On gyro frequency?
No, I didn't do it with TWIS. Richard put my name on it. I had pointed out to him that this had never been done, and he was so staggered he went off and did it in high-powered arithmetic, which I don't understand.
I see.
And insisted in putting my name on it.
Okay. But it was a negative result, essentially, that gyro frequency did not explain these bursts.
Yeah, well, the real question was that they had not taken account of the refractive index of the medium in calculating synchrotron radiation. Now, there's been a lot of work done. At around about the same time as his paper appeared, there was one by Eitman. Eitman, E-I-D-M-A-N, the Russian, which is one of the fundamental papers in the subject. And since then, there's been a lot of work, particularly by the Russians, on synchrotron emission in plasmas. But that Twist and Roberts paper is really the start of that work, in a sense.
Okay, so you got to Caltech, and what did you find there?
Well, I found an interferometer in the building. as I recall, one of the 90-footers was complete, or just about complete. I know I have lots of slides of pieces being lifted up for one of them. John Boltman was in charge. He'd been invited by DeBridge to come and set up a radio astronomy group, and he'd taken Gordon Stanley with him. He'd got Kevin Westphal to come over for a year and Kevin was there when I arrived, and not long afterwards, it was that stage that Kevin wrote the synchrotron radiation paper,
mm-hmm.
the first Westfall paper.
He gave, I noticed going through his bibliography, a course of lectures at Caltech. Did you sit on those for chance?
No, before I got there. I did have a copy of his notes at one stage.
You don't have that now? I wanted to look that up.
I might have it, I could look
it up. Yeah, okay. But I guess you got to Caltech in late 58 then, after these...
Yes, it probably September or something like that in 58.
And what was the first thing that you yourself worked on at Caltech?
Well, of course, the answer to that is installing pipes and pulling wires and generally learning something about getting telescopes going. Now let's think. I think as soon as they got going, see, one got going first.
Right.
John Bolton's a man to talk to because he'd remember it. He having had to direct the
thing. Right. I will be talking to him.
But there was this sky survey. Dan Harris was one of the students there,
mm-hmm.
and I guess the idea was that he and I were supposed to be looking at all the three sea sources, and as Dan will explain to you, occasionally in the middle of the night he'd go to sleep and so he'd discover CDA 102 or something like this because the telescope had gone on beyond the three sea sources. Actually, Dan did most of the observing for that.
This was a paper you published in 1960 in the PASP.
I guess that's where it is. Now, well, I can't really remember. That was whether that was single dish work or interferometer work.
That was a single dish.
Right.
And apparently the conclusion from that was that the 3C was pretty reliable.
Yes, I think so.
And I guess your motivation to check it was because the 2C had been so bad. And
let's say it was John Bolton's motivation to check it. I mean, I suppose if I'd really got to thinking about it, since I knew all about the 2C being bad from Bernie Mills' work, I might have thought of it, but
right.
John was the boss, and John was at that stage certainly determining the research program.
Let's see now. You also worked with Gordon Stanley looking at Jupiter with
yes.
that single dish.
Now that was the fascinating thing. That John Bolton went off to some meeting, I don't know where, and he came back via NRL, I think, where Connie Meyer or was it
Well, all three of them, McCullough and Sloniker.
Sloniker had measured Jupiter at a couple of high frequencies.
10 centimeters and 3 centimeters.
And 3 centimeters. And they'd found the 3 centimeters, I think, was more or less what you'd expect from thermal, and the 10 was a bit more. And John came back with this and with the idea that this might be going on down to low frequencies and might be quite a strong source at low frequencies. Go up and look at it at 31 centimeters. So we went up and looked at it at 31 centimeters. And after a bit of a struggle, we got a bump there which was bigger than the wobbles in the receiver output. And decided that sure enough it was a lot stronger and it did have a vastly non-thermal spectrum.
You came up with a brightness temperature for the disk of, if it were disk size, of 5,500 kelvins.
I believe it.
No.
It's so long now.
And say that the origin of the radiation is unknown, so I gather this was a real puzzle then, what was going on.
If we said the origin was unknown, I guess that's what we were thinking, but it was around about the time the Van Allen belt was discovered, and Frank Drake appeared in print, or Drake and Barton or someone, very much around mm-hmm. about this time with the suggestion it was a similar process. It was radiation from radiation belt.
That's right. Now, there's one other paper with a single antenna before we get to the interferometer, and that's with yourself, Bolton, and Harris, looking at Hydra A and Hercules A, and suggesting possible identifications.
I suspect that's a paper I'd like to forget. I certainly have forgotten it. It was Hydra and Hercules. I think it was measuring the position.
Right, just getting better positions.
Of Hercules, and I think it was wrong, as I remember.
Well, that I haven't checked on.
But it was something which John thought was important to do, and I forget how we did it or what answer we got.
Okay, well, let's move on to the interferometer. What did you do on the interferometer?
Now here I'll probably get the order of things wrong, but as a group project, you see, with John directing, the interferometer got going and was measuring source positions. And I can certainly remember myself, seeing all these sine waves on charts and measuring them up and measuring off positions and this sort of thing. Somewhere around about here, and I'm not sure whether it was after we'd measured a lot of positions or really before the interferometer got going properly, for some reason we decided it was important to measure whether Jupiter had any linear polarization. Now, whether we'd actually got a paper from George Field where he predicted or he discussed cyclotron radiation, mm-hmm. or whether we'd simply carried on from the idea it was a radiation belt, and if so, it might be synchrotron or something like that, might be polarized, I don't know. But I remember being up at Big Pine where the radio observatory is, and Al Munger, he's called Big Al, he's a great big fellow. He was the site manager. And I said, I wanted to rotate the feed on this thing. And Big Al went off and he got a ring gear, off the starter of a car. And he somehow rigged this up so we finally rotated the feed. And we chuffed around and we sure enough found some polarization. And then Rad must have come up from Pasadena on the end of this, I think, and Rad actually did the angular size measurements.
That's right, that was also in that paper in PhysRev Letter.
Yeah. And they were exciting days because, this really did show that the stuff was coming from a radiation belt because of the angular resolution Rad had managed to do. And the polarization showed pretty clearly that it was, some sort of strange radiation. And we pretty quickly concluded that it wasn't cyclotron, that it was synchrotron.
On what basis?
That, I'm not sure. I've read reviews of this subject recently, and obviously the published literature gives a different impression from my memories. I think in our paper, or one of our papers somewhere, we said that on the cyclotron theory, in the cyclotron theory, the radiation of a particular frequency has to come from a particular magnetic latitude because it has to be where the cyclotron frequency is equal to the observing frequency. And so as you change frequency, you expect the polarization to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in one of our published things we say that you'd expect that, and we almost imply that it doesn't happen, but whether we actually had the evidence, I don't know. And,
I see.
I'm really not quite clear how we concluded that it wasn't cyclotron.
Well, I'll have to check those papers and see if I can straighten that out. But in any case, this was all rather surprising results from Jupiter, I guess, at that time. What can you tell me about the Caltech group at that time? Seems to me like it
a very happy group. It was the last group I was in that was small enough to be a really good, close-knit group.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, up to the time that I left CSIRO to go to Caltech, I think all the groups here had been small. I mean, the group under Paul Weiler-Dapp was colossal. There were just enough of us that we all knew what everybody was doing. We got together a lot and so on. It was before the days of the big observatories.
Right.
And the Caltech group was like this. There was John Bolton, Gordon Stanley.
Ken Kellerman and Clark, were they there yet?
No. Well, right on the staff, there was
Reed?
Canadian chap, Matthews.
Tom Matthews, yeah.
Tom Matthews, right. Well, it might not have been on the staff. He might have been a research associate.
He was a student.
Yeah. No, he's not a student. Not when I was.
Oh, no, you're right. He got his degree at Harvard. You're right.
Mm. No, I think he was perhaps a research associate, yeah. which I think is what I was called. And then of the students, well, at least during the time I was there, I'm not sure what order they came. Oh, and of course, Radhakrishnan arrived.
And was it Dave Morris there also?
And Dave Morris arrived while I was there. I'm not sure which order they came or just when they came. I think Rad came first and not too long after I arrived. Now, students that may have been there or may have arrived while I was there was Dan Harris, there was Al Moffat, Dick Reed, Ken Kellerman,
Barry Clark.
Barry Clark, yes. Now, Glenn Berg may have come just before I left, I'm not sure.
I think he was a bit later.
I've got a feeling there's someone else, but.
But in any case, it was a very close-knit group.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, even the secretaries and John Harriman, who ran the electronics shop and produced the morning coffee and so on, it was all a nice group. And quite closely liaison with the optical people, Jesse Greenstein particularly.
Now, are you implying that when you got back to CSIRO that things had changed here in terms of the...
No, in the early days of Parkes it was good. Well, it was different in that the construction people were still on the site and there were just a few of us would go up. For instance, we were trying to determine the shape of the dish and things like that, and then we got involved in the pointing of the dish. And in fact, I suppose for quite some years there was a much more relaxed attitude than there is now. And I think it was partly because we only worked half nights. We had the nights split between two different groups. So you didn't flog yourself to death. You went up and you worked for a half night and there was time to play ping pong and they even built tennis courts and talked about building swimming pools. And but slowly we've become more a big institution. The big staff up there, and you have to behave yourself, and you are, you know, more isolated from other members of the group, I think.
Is this solely a result of size?
I suspect so. I think that if you get a small group, you can do it. If you get a big group, you have to have different rules. And we might also become more serious people.
Perhaps.
Yeah. You hear that. The talks of the wartime carrying on around the lab, they realised they weren't very serious in those days.
So, what were the first projects you worked on when you got back?
Linear polarisation. Well, firstly there were things about the dish. And I, with John Whiteoak, got involved in the pointing of the telescope quite early on, but I suspect we were already doing astronomical observing for other purposes too. And the first project that we really got going on was Max Kamisaro from himself on Jupiter. As I was saying at tea, I came back, you know, saying one of the things I wanted to do was look for linear polarization. You know, having founded the Jupiter at Caltech, and these are jolly well supposed to be synchrotron sources, well, there ought to be some polarization. Sure, lots of people have tried before and haven't found any, but, you know, let's have a go.
Well, it had been found in the Crab, of course.
It had been found in the Crab, and around about that time in Cygnus, I think, by Connie. But
in most radio sources, no.
Most radio sources, no. And people have been trying, you know, ever since the early days of radio astronomy. And there had been this work on the polarization of the background radiation too. Mm-hmm. And, I think I'm right in saying that stage was being questioned by...
There were some Russian results that were being...
Was it Russian? Yes, I think it was Russian results.
Can't remember the guy's name now, but it was late 50s.
That's right.
Westerhout had found only an upper limit at 21 centimeters. Or 1% or something.
I know Pawsey was very interested in that. And he and someone else, you know, some junior person in the lab, wrote a paper, which was probably never published, on how to do it, you know, what sort of techniques you ought to use to try and find linear polarization in the background. This was low frequencies, you know, they're talking about 150 megs or something like that. Mm. They may even have done some observations, they certainly didn't find anything that they published. Anyway, at the time I came back from Caltech, that was certainly my interest. As it turned out, well now, people always say, what about Ron Bracewell? I forget even the history there, that Ron came, you know, on a visit. I think the machine with the polarization properties had just been installed on the telescope or something like this, and he said, you know, why don't we take a look at that Centaurus, and he was lucky enough to find it. See, the message was, what came out after a year's observation was that at high enough frequencies, things are polarized, and people have simply been looking at low frequencies where it's having to be depolarized. And anyway, before very long, I seem to remember we got into a pattern where Frank Gardner and John White had one half of the night, and Max Tomasarov and I had the other half of the night, and Frank and John were doing radio service in general, and we were doing Jupiter. And we pretty soon found enough in Jupiter to keep us amused. So that that's the way it's split.
Well, something just came to mind. Would you say also that the installation of the Parkes dish as being the major instrument for the entire division also was an important factor in shaping the, changing the nature of the...
Oh, that's essentially what changed it. Before that, there were a lot of different groups, each with its own field station, to a large extent.
And now you've had everyone competing for time on this dish.
Yes.
That ends the interview with Jim Roberts on 28th February 78 at CSIRO, and this is the end of this side of the tape.